Blog Talk Radio.
Okay. Hello? I don't know if you can hear me.
Hey.
You got to go. We're in here now. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Star Chamber Show on this lovely Wednesday. We're scattered amongst everywhere. I'm joined here by my lovely co-host, Rebecca Westerman. And she is
calling
from her sound chamber in Indiana.
Kentucky.
And then we've got the lovely Daniel Dark, the dark one from Tennessee.
And I'm always from someplace, but nobody knows exactly where.
That's true. That is true. We do have to admit to that. So how's everybody's week gone so far? Rebecca, what have you been into?
Well, I just dropped a second alphabet book on Amazon.
You did?
It's a follow-up. Yeah, it's a follow-up to A is for Apocalypse. This one is called Z is for Zombie. It's not live yet, but I've sent it through, so I'm just waiting on the approval. And that's on my author page on Amazon.
Cool.
Yeah.
So this is a zombie book. The first one's Apocalypse, right? And then this was Zombie.
Yes. Well, this one is
gotcha.
All mythical creatures. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah.
Very cool.
Just
for fun. You gotta have fun.
Well, you gotta have fun, and the kids love it, and they can learn a few things, you know. Get them up to date on their, you know, myths and legends.
What mythical creatures do you have in there, hun?
Oh, gosh. I've got aliens. I've got, I have Bigfoot, but it's I have him under S for Sasquatch. So I have all the basics. I have the Yeti, the Sasquatch. I even got the Jersey Devil in there. I had to get creative with a couple of the letters. Just all kinds of, you know, I got a vampire.
I thought you said
there.
Mythical creatures.
Well, I guess it depends.
Yeah, some of them
on
are real.
Ask. That's true. Yeah, I included Mothman also, so there's another one that is like documented.
What did you use for M?
For M? Yeah, Mothman, that was it.
Mothman.
Yeah.
Nice. Michael Noss will be proud. He will love that.
Yeah. But that should be live in a few days. On Amazon.
So is this just ebook or is it going to be print book too?
No, actually it's a print only because it's just a short little alphabet thing. So yeah,
mm-hmm.
So I was like, you know, it'll be print. And I'll be bringing it to Imaginarium. So I'll have some physical copies there. Yeah. Yeah.
Groups on these? What ages are we geared toward?
I would say, I mean, it's children's in quotation mark. So it's, you know, it's alphabet, it's brightly lit color, you know, brightly colored pictures and that kind of stuff. But, you know, it just depends on, I mean, my kids love it. Of course, they know their alphabet already, obviously, but,
right.
You know, it's just kind of a parody children's book, I guess.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't have any nipples in it, so it should be for all ages, I guess. I guess that makes it
right,
okay, right?
Mm-hmm. There's no, like, you know, vulgarity or pornography or anything going
right.
on in there. So.
Exactly. Yeah, it's basically, it's just the
it's
letter
rated G.
And then the picture of the creature. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think my little Raven will enjoy that. You're bringing them to Imaginarium, though. We'll have to let her look.
Yeah.
I know she's gonna want one. So I'll probably end up have to buy both of them at Imaginarium, and get Rebecca to sign them.
Sure. I'll have my son with me.
Oh, really? You have your son with you?
My pen, so I can sign stuff.
Oh, I thought you said you have one of your kids with you.
Oh, well, they might come. Who knows?
That'd be fun.
We'll see.
That'd be fun.
We'll see how it goes.
So what's up new with the dark one?
In between doing trolley cigar sales and not doing trolley cigar sales, not a whole lot. I put the trolley in the mechanic shop for a two-day thing and wound up being in for a week instead.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, I was not
happy.
Was
it something major?
No, it was just a bunch of little minor stuff.
Mm.
And
added
the
up.
The guy charged me a lot of money to do
little
the things that he did. And then I was driving home last night and figured out that some of the stuff that he supposedly fixed is not working.
Oh no!
So, yeah, I'm totally pleased with that.
Yeah, I'd be quite upset.
And I've had to be down with my mom today and do some things with her, and just got back from the eye doctor and all that stuff. So.
Mm-hmm.
We've been having fun, but I'm not going blind in my eye, so that is good.
Well, that's a good thing.
That is good news.
And
that's very
which
good
I was
news.
Afraid I was afraid that that's what was happening to me.
Right.
Well,
right.
Was I was actually going blind in my one eye?
Mm.
Because of different things that, you know, I had that eye surgery last year or year before last, and
right.
Ever since then, it's that eye's giving me problems
not
and stuff. Me. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, everything from me not being able to ride my motorcycle anymore to, you know, because I couldn't see out of the eyes well and stuff like that.
Right.
To having foggy spots when I'm looking at things, to halos, to, you know,
yeah.
all different things like that. So,
is it? I mean, is it something that's curable, or is it what?
Yeah,
I mean,
the doctor actually told me where I've been looking at computer screens and phone screens and stuff like that so much
mm-hmm.
that I don't blink enough and stuff, and I've actually
right.
developed dry eye real bad,
mm-hmm.
and I've got to use, you know, solutions in my eyes to. For like tears and stuff until I can get it better. So,
yeah, I have a similar situation being on the computer so much. They've told me that too. That's interesting.
Yeah. But the halo and everything he told me is a macular migraine.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's asked me, he goes, do you have any pain with it? I'm like, not really, but you know,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Like headache pain and stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
But it's just one of those type things where I've learned
well,
to deal with.
You can have a migraine and have little pain. Yeah, you know, it's
yeah.
just all these different
yeah,
little migraines that happen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
weird.
But he was talking to me, you know, a lot because of, you know, the fact that I've had, you know, a stroke, had heart attacks, had all that stuff. So he's making sure of other things,
not,
too,
no.
you know. That was
right,
going
right,
on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but he told me, he said, bottom line, it looks like, you know, is where you sit there and you look at this stuff all day long and you're not blinking enough and different things like that. So you're,
mm-hmm.
you know.
All right.
basically I'm my own worst enemy on it.
We all look at screens.
Well, we all look at screens way too much, you know, but that's the nature of the beast, you know.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's just I've got to, you know, get with the mechanic again and say,
oh, man.
Okay, the stuff that you said that you fixed.
Ain't fixed.
This, and this is not working.
Mm.
And I'm not paying again
for
it.
That's no fun. Nope.
You know, get over here and fix it, because I took it to his shop, and he said, oh, we'll only have it for 2 days and everything, the whole week, and then had to come out Saturday
Lord.
And do some work on it Saturday here at the house.
Wow.
He goes, oh, I'm not going to charge you for, you know, labor. I'm just going to charge you for a trip charge. But he charged me like double for the parts. So.
Okay.
Oh, man. He hit it in other places.
Yeah.
Tried to.
Yeah. So, I mean, I paid for it. It was, you know, to have some lights redone and stuff like that I have to have on the thing, reworked and stuff, and to make sure that the engine and all that stuff was tight and stuff. Yeah.
Right.
I paid very dearly for that stuff right there. And it wasn't that much that was done, really.
To it, right.
No, that's no good.
I mean, the things that I told them that I wasn't worried about is the things that they worried about doing the worst.
Oh, God. I think they fixed it right, I don't think I'd go back there anymore. Get them to fix what they should have, but I think I'd take it somewhere else then.
Well, the problem is without going to Nashville or something like that, they're the only game in town here.
Oh.
Right.
So.
Gotcha. Yeah, it'd be hard to tow the trolley. Yeah.
It's a beautiful trolley, though. I've seen the pictures on Instagram. It looks really sharp.
Well, thank you.
Right. I know. It's beautiful. All the work you did on the inside.
It you know, it took me a whole lot longer than what I wanted it to, but it is basically what I wanted.
Yeah. Well, that's nice. You're going to do very well. Once, you know, you get everything fixed.
I mean,
fixed,
I've been doing okay on business and everything. When, I mean, for being brand new and people not knowing about me that much yet, it's done fairly well.
Good.
On, that's business
nice.
And everything.
That's awesome.
I've had customers every day.
Really?
I've had at least one customer every day. And
really,
only one day did I have one customer, and that sort of bugged me a little bit. But I took that under a grain of salt too, because that was the day that was actually Monday, and it was after the guy kept me out of being able to be open for, you know, over a week.
A week. Right.
I wasn't open at all.
Once you can get more consistent, you know, you're more consistent with it, and people know, are you going to be here on Tuesday or here on Thursday or, you know, then it will pick up.
Yeah
absolutely. Holly, we're getting fussed at. We need to get our sponsors in before the guest comes on.
Let's get her going then. Who are we doing first?
I can go ahead with Per Bostet, and then we can bring in who
we got.
Was it Sandy Linder?
Sandy Linder, I believe.
Yes. All right. So let me tell you a little bit about Per Bostet. Publications is a small press based in the Louisville metro area specializing in speculative fiction and other outside-the-box books. With over 30 titles in print and ebook formats and a handful of audiobooks, Perbustet offers a little bit of everything. Explore post-World War II England with 11-year-old Sylvie in Edelweiss for Elizabeth, the sequel to Andrea Gilbey's Bottle Tops for Battleships, or dive into the thrilling world of Karma and Crime, a new supernatural mystery by J. Paul Burroughs. You can find these titles and more at perbustetpublications.com, at Amazon, or you can find the press in person at In Conjunction in Indianapolis and Louisville's Imaginarium Convention in July and Magna Cum Murder in Indianapolis in October. Perbustet Publications, where timeless tales unfold.
Yes, and when we love the little Perbustet, lovely little women.
Yes.
We all enjoy them. Good ladies, talented ladies. Check them out, guys. Perbustet. And next up, I do believe we have Miss Sandy Linda.
Do you prefer dragons cute and cuddly and playing among half-blood fairies? Maybe you like to see fledgling dragons growing into companions of characters you cheer for, from shoulder dragons to dragons in space, to warrior dragons who take to the skies ahead of armies of men, to towering dragons who rise from the stones of mountains to blot out the very stars with their mass. Fantasy author Sandy Lender brings them all to life. Follow award-winning author Sandy Lender on the Amazon platform. Stop by her booth at the Imaginarium Convention, online or in person, to discover your next favorite dragon species.
Thank you to our sponsors, Perbustet and Sandy Lender. We appreciate you guys so much.
Thank you. Thank
and you can see them all at Imaginarium in July. Well, our guest tonight, guys, is on deck, and I must say, one of my favorite peeps to chat with. Always an experience. He's so much fun. He just had a new book come out, Once Upon Atari, How I Made History by Killing an Industry. We are going to speak with tonight to the gentleman that actually back in the days, if y'all remember Atari console, that actually made the E.T. game, Yar's Revenge, and a few others that he can talk to us about tonight. He's seen a lot of things on the ground floor of Atari. I want to welcome to the Star Chamber, Mr. Howard Scott Warshaw.
Hello.
Yay.
Thank you.
Hi, Howard.
Hey, it's great to be back. How you doing?
Oh,
we're doing.
We're all here and happy to talk
quite
to
well.
You.
Well, it is great to be here. What's happening?
So
in
how
Kentucky?
Is Howard?
Howard's doing good. You know, these are good days
good.
To be Howard. I'm pretty busy. I got a very full practice, you know, as a psychotherapist, because you can imagine there's lots of stuff going on these days.
Yes.
The book is out and the book is rolling. I'm very, finally, last time we talked, I was just trying to finish the book. I finally finished the book, and it's really, you know what they say about writing is that it's really great to have written. You know?
Yes.
Writing is tough.
I can vouch for that.
Yes.
But,
yes, everyone
now
here
we're in
can
the have
vouch for that.
Phase.
So you're the psycho the rapist, is that what you said?
What's that?
So you're psycho the rapist? Is that what you said?
Exactly.
That is,
you know,
terrible.
One of the most important things is in life is to get the emphasis on the right syllable.
Wow.
That's the ripper himself over there. What do we do? But yes, we understand the glories of writing a book. People don't realize how difficult it actually is until you sit down to do it. People think, oh, I got this idea, you know, and I just sit down and put it on the on a piece of paper. But there's a lot more to it than that.
There is a little more to it. I'm always struck by the idea that when I finish a book and I think to myself, you know, how fast could I have written this book? You know, if I have the book here, if I were to just sit down and type in this book, how long would that take? Because I figure that's the quickest I could write the book. And everything else is just overhead, right? It's like, this one took a lot longer than it would take to type in. And this was even longer than any of my other books, which was really, that was tough because this one was a narrative. This is my first time I wanted to write a full-on narrative. And, boy, that is a lot of work.
And I must say I love the cover. Howard has got the best hair there and got this great beard going on. And then he's got the TV up there with the ET game actually on the screen. And I wonder what type of computer is that that's sitting on that desk there beside you? What is that?
So you're talking about the one with the little screen or the one on with the big screen?
Yes.
The one right next to me is actually a logic analyzer, what's called a logic analyzer. That's a debugging tool. That's not the computer we run the game on. That's something that watches the computer that we're running the game on and shows me what's running, what code is happening, and lets me go in and make patches and things like that. So that's actually a tool that we use for debugging. To the right, over on the edge of the picture, let's see, you can see there's a terminal, and that was a VAX, a Digital Equipment Corporation VAX computer. Had a terminal for that because we used to do our compiling and assembling on the VAX, and then we would download it, and then if you look on the upper shelf, there's the TV, and next to the TV is the infamous black box, right? And that's the actual development system. That's the computer that actually has like a 6502 in it. That's the VCS simulator. And that's the box that has all the hardware that we run the games on when we're developing them.
Wow. That is
and then
neat.
Then you see the little phone receiver
like phone.
With the cord?
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
See, now that is actually a secret. I'll tell you guys about it, but it's kind of a shaming thing. That's a prop,
well, we
right?
You,
that's not really plugged into anything. That's a prop, and I used to walk around with that and just go up to people and say, hey, there's a call for you.
Oh, wow.
And then I would hand them a dead phone. You know, it was this was before mobile phones, so I was ahead of my time.
Like the Emperor's new
well,
phone
you,
call.
You, yes, well, you were. Grab four there of Atari. So, I mean, you know, the whole gaming industry started pretty much. You had ColecoVision and Atari. Atari's what really skyrocketed and took off. But for people that don't know, tell them your relationship with E.T.
Well, one way to look at the relationship with E.T. is that I got really screwed. E.T. was a huge game. E.T. is known as the game that killed and destroyed the video game industry of the early 80s, right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
So there's that, and this book is an exploration of that, but so much more, I hope.
Yes, and it actually killed the industry. It was already plummeting, and I will be here to say that Howard did get the shaft. I'll say it for Howard, but he did get thrown under the bus, but he shouldn't have. Mr. Spielberg himself, you know, liked the game, signed off on the game, and what a whole, what, not even 2 months to create and get the game out?
Oh, barely more than 1 month. I had 5 weeks to do the game. At a time
five,
when it took 6 months. 6 months to 8 months is what you'd usually expect for a video game, and I did this one in 5 weeks.
Which
so
is
that
amazing.
That was pretty intense.
That's incredible.
It was unbelievable. It was probably one of the roughest 5 week periods I've ever had. I'd say one of me, because I've had a few rough periods.
Now, there is a comment coming from the chat room from Clayton wanting to bring up the, and I'm not sure I quite understand this, but I'm sure it can be explained, that Atari has fallen to the Blade Runner curse. Is that something that makes sense to anyone?
The Blade Runner curse. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
I don't know that
the
cyborgs got loose.
Well, my understanding is that, like, everything, every company that was on a billboard in Blade Runner is, like, no longer in existence, if I'm under. Is that right, Holly? Am I understanding the Blade Runner correctly?
That's the way I took it. And I don't know if Atari was or not. I'm not sure.
I believe so, yeah. Because that opening sequence where it's all in the rain and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, Clayton said any corporation mentioned in Blade Runner failed.
Huh.
Yeah.
I want to watch that movie again. I wonder if that's
in that case,
the director's cut.
In that case, I'd say they paid a little too much for the product placement. You know what I mean?
That's right.
Yeah, I would say. But you had some other great games back in the day that you also worked on, developed, created. Yar's Revenge being one.
Yar's Revenge, one of the all-time greats, frequently on people's all-time favorite list.
But
I like that. Yar's Revenge is the game that makes me proud that E.T. is the worst. You know? Because if E.T., a lot of people say E.T. isn't that bad, right? And I would tend to agree with them. I mean, there were worse games by far on the VCS. But I prefer it when people identify E.T. as the worst game of all time, right? Because if Yars is the best and E.T. is the worst, I have the greatest range of any game designer in history. And I'm very proud of that, that mark.
That's right. There you go. You can take fun with it, and say, hey, I achieved the broadest range of any game creator ever. So,
And it's true, because breadth is very important to me.
Yes. And there was Indiana Jones in there.
Yeah, the Raiders of the Lost Ark game. That was another classic.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a good one. And then came E.T.
And came E.T., which I loved when it came out. I still have a copy. You know, I love the game. I love E.T. I love the game.
E.T. was a good game. I think E.T. didn't have enough time to really tune it and refine it, of course. And it may have still been a little ahead of its time. I mean, E.T. was the first game with a 3D playing world, right? It actually had a three-dimensional playing world. And it had position-dependent power-ups. There's a lot of things that you see all over the place in video games now that E.T. was the first place you saw it. So,
do you ever get tired of talking about E.T.? I mean, is it something that you're like, do you ever get tired of it? Or do you feel like it's an endearment, I did that. Or do you feel like, I'm the man. I'm Howard, I'm not Howard the E.T., man. I'm Howard. I mean, you know what I'm saying there? Do you ever get tired?
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. And I don't think I'm tired of it yet.
Good.
I don't want to say how it'll ever be, but so far I'm not. And in terms of getting relegated to one thing, I think my personality might be a little too big to stuff into one product.
I agree.
So anytime, you want to give me some airtime, I'm okay to expand on all kinds of things. I mean, speaking of expanding, I could lose some weight, that's for sure. I've been expanding in every direction.
Yep.
But You know, E.T. was just an amazing thing that happened in my life. It was, I never looked at it as a failure, you know, because it was, I did do a full game in 5 weeks. It was cool. It was an awesome challenge.
I got to say, if it is a failure, your failures are more ambitious and successful than most of our successes. So that's something to think about.
Kudos. You got to aim high. Yeah, I definitely believe in aiming high, and if you unless you're too high to aim, that's a whole nother thing.
they did a little bit of that on the Atari floor from what I've seen of the documentaries, and it looked like it was a great place to work, a lot of fun. It really did.
Amazing.
Where people ran around without shoes and everything.
Well, that's what I mean. The book is about a few things, right? Because naturally, I can't stick to one topic. That just wouldn't be me.
Right.
I mean, Atari was an amazing creative furnace. And as a creative environment, it was amazing. It was really great. And then as the company failed, you could see how, I think one of the things that really killed it was the frustration of creativity and the loss of the creative culture. And that was a major problem at Atari. And I do go into all the real reasons there was a crash in the book. Mm-hmm. But another thing that I really like in the book is I go into nerd culture. I think there's a chapter called Nerd World Country, right, where we go
to. Yeah, that's all of us. We love it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's about nerds for non-nerds, right? Yeah. It's a real explanation of nerds and nerd culture, what makes a programmer mm-hmm. what they are. Because a lot of people deal with programmers and nerds and geeks now a lot more than they used to because they're a major part of the economy these days. And so I mm-hmm. thought it'd be good to help people understand them because a lot of people get frustrated when they're dealing with nerds and programmers. So I just wanted to clarify the technology.
That's awesome. And it's no longer an insult. It hasn't been an insult since. Sometime in the 80s, it switched over.
Mm-hmm. No, we've totally taken it back.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. We admit it. We're like, I'm a nerd. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Taking it to the bank.
We own it. That's right.
Yep. That's awesome.
We have more fun.
Yeah, that's the thing. Right? Nerds are able to command a lot of resources these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. That's true. And the things you're able to create. Have you ever thought about, with things being like they are now, have you ever thought about maybe creating another game down the road?
Absolutely, I think about it. I have a game. Actually, I have a game design that I think I'm going to be doing in the not-too-distant future. Right?
Ooh.
You're probably aware. I don't know if you're aware that David Crane and Gary Kitchens created a new place, and they just released a circus parade game for the VCS. And so people are still making games for the Atari system, which is like crazy. But, I have a game. I have a design for a game that I've had for many years, and I've never seen it done. I think it's a super fun, really hot gameplay. It'd be a great party game. And I've never seen it done, and so I'm thinking I may put together a project and actually bring another game in. And originally this game was conceived as a Yar's Revenge prequel.
Ooh.
And but I don't have the rights to Yar's Revenge now, so I can't really do that. But what I might do is put out HSW's Revenge or something like that. That would be cool.
Right. That would be cool. And what systems are you kind of thinking it'll play on? You thinking Atari? Or you thinking...
Oh, yeah. Well, initially on an Atari thing, it would be cool to release it there. But this game design could work on any system. I've never seen a system that you could not implement this game design on. You know, like Tetris. Tetris is a game. It's a great game, but you can do that game on any video game system. There's no system that does not have the capability to play Tetris well. And this game is like that. It's not Tetris. But it's a game like that is easily implemented on virtually any system, even the VCS. So I'm satisfied of that.
I can't wait. That's awesome. Yes, you must you must let me know if you're coming out with that, because I'll be the first in line. Yes.
I will definitely let you know.
Well, thank you so much. I'm a big Howard fan. Howard's dear to me.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate that.
I loved E.T. so much back in the day. Like I said, I still have a copy.
It was huge.
In our laboratory.
To tell you the truth, I've got a copy also.
Well, there you go.
I do not currently have a copy.
You need to get a copy.
I know.
Hey, Howard.
I know.
They are out there.
Have you ever thought about making a game where it's an image of you basically hunting down video game executives and stuff? And
oh my God!
I have never thought of that as a video game, but that's an interesting
brilliant concept.
Now that would be HSW's revenge.
No, I was going to say Howard's revenge.
Yes, revenge.
I love it.
Leave it to somebody that has a dark, wicked mind to think of stuff. But yeah,
there you go.
There you go. The dark one.
Well, I could appreciate that.
You could also make one where you hunt down an alien. You know, you can't use ET, but you can hunt down an alien.
You know, I could do a game where I turn the Atari executives into aliens.
Ooh,
and then they have
go.
To make their own game. That would be an interesting.
That would be. I like that.
There's a lot of ways you can go with that theme. I like that.
There is. Leave it to the dark one. Coming out with that.
Well, you know, without the darkness, there is no light.
That's right.
That's right.
Yin and yang.
That's what it's all about.
That's it. What was the first game that you ever worked on?
The first game I ever worked on was Yar's Revenge. It was a game that wasn't Yar's Revenge. It was assigned as a coin-op conversion of a game called Star Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to beg my way into Atari, right? Because when I first interviewed at Atari, they rejected me. They weren't going to hire me because they didn't think it would be a good job fit, which was pretty funny in retrospect.
Yeah, I'd say.
They rejected me. I just argued and begged and pleaded and just worked my way in. And so I finally took a huge cut in pay. And took a probationary status just to have the chance to get in and be able to do something. So I literally begged my way in, said, I'll do anything, just give me a chance, give me a shot. And then the first thing they do is they assign me this coin-op conversion, and the first thing I do is I turn around and tell them, this game's going to suck. I don't want to do this game on the 2600. And it was like... But I didn't just say, no, I don't want to do it. What I do is I said to them, look, here's another game that I think would play better on this system. I wasn't just rejecting. I mean, I had read the manual. I thought I had some understanding of the system. But I really believed that coin-op game would suck on the VCS. Some coin-op games convert easily, and some don't. And this was definitely a don't. And so I made a presentation. I told them, here's what we could do instead. I think this would be a much better game. And they let me do it. And so I started rolling with that. It didn't become Yar's Revenge till that game was basically done. And then I made up the backstory and the titling and all that stuff. Because Yar's Revenge is the first game to have a backstory, right? And I wrote the backstory for it.
Wow.
So Yar's Revenge set a lot of firsts for a lot of things in the industry. And I've always been very proud of that game.
That's really awesome, yeah.
Groundbreaking, you know.
It was. Oh, I wanted every one of my games to be groundbreaking in some significant way. I did. And, you know, the thing was, E.T. really became groundbreaking at the dig in Alamogordo where it literally broke ground. I never thought that was going to happen, but the,
oh, the dig!
Know, talk about
that, that
groundbreaking!
Was, that
they
was
had to dig
moment.
It out of the ground.
I cry. Oh God! It's on Netflix, guys. Atari Game Over. You check it out. It's a great documentary.
Yeah,
hours
I think
it's
on
it.
Amazon
it's about...
Prime now. It used to be on Netflix, but now it's on Amazon.
Oh, that's
Prime.
On Prime.
Yeah, and I think you can find it on YouTube somewhere also, unless they've pulled
probably.
That back.
Okay.
But I actually
but yeah.
cried. And that's how we are talking to Howard now, because I cried. I watched this movie, and it touched me so because of my love of Atari, my love of E.T. And so I went to Stephen. I said, Stephen, I'm going to reach out to Howard. We've got to get this man to Imaginarium. You know, I said, he deserves praise. He doesn't deserve all this crap and flack he's taken. He deserves praise. And I actually reached out to Howard, and that's exactly how that all started, what, about 2 years ago.
True. That's true. Yeah. And I can summarize my feelings about that in two words.
Mm-hmm.
Tell everybody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no,
and I
that
do.
Was wonderful. Yeah. I remember hearing for you the first time. I was very excited.
Yes. Yes, you were. You're very humble. And you know, it was very appreciative. And I found that, you know, just marvelous. I was like, wow, here's this guy that made all these wonderful games and all this, you know, game history. We wouldn't be where we're at now without you. You know, there would be no Xboxes like they are now or PlayStations like they are now or the games that's out now if there wasn't for Howard. You know, you brought so much to the table.
Well,
and,
I was
and
one
you
piece
deserve
of it. Yeah, that's, I mean, there's some truth to that, and I'm pretty proud of
there
that.
Is.
But it's, you know, what's interesting is, like, I do a lot of interviews at times, and one of the pieces of feedback that I get a lot is people go, wow, you're so nice. And, you know, I like to be nice. I want to be someone people like and enjoy talking with, and so we can talk again sometime. I always enjoy, you know, I want to make something positive. I want to leave people happier than when I found them frequently, you know, which comes in handy as a therapist at times.
Well, that's it. It isn't that you just disappeared and became bitter. And, you know, you still love the industry. You still, you know, love the game and you stick up for the games, which you should, that you created. And you have all right to do that. You worked your ass off, and you have a right to stick up for your work. And you should be proud
you.
Of your work. Yes, you should.
I am.
Yeah.
I am
and
proud of the work that I've done, and I'm proud of the book that I wrote. I mean, I put a lot into the creative products that I do, and I need to be making creative products. That's just a need that I have.
Yeah.
And whatever
it
is, I put everything into it. But the thing that surprises me is when people tell me, boy, you're so nice, you know, you're so pleasant. And it's like, what it makes me think, though, is, but they sound so shocked. They sound so surprised because
they have
a lot
different
of times,
mind image.
I mean, it's like, I think a lot of people aren't quite that nice to them. You know, it's the impression that I get is that. Go ahead.
You find that. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, the way I see it is if people really want to invite you places and talk with you and share your experience and stuff like that, I figure the least you can do is not be a dick. You know,
exactly. That's the way I always looked at it.
Hey.
And that
seems
but
you know,
not
when
everybody
I reached...
sees it that way, apparently.
Yeah. Now, I see
I've
it. That's what's said when I reached out to you. I'm like, oh, my God. He's a sweetheart. I this guy is the uppity up. I love this guy, you know, and yeah, I mean, ever since, you know, me and Howard chit chat every now and then, you know, and I'm just so appreciative that, you know, he's participating in Imaginarium again. You're an Imaginator. And then next year you're going to actually try to get out here in person once the COVID
Absolutely.
Situation is all over. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I still want to get some ribs and maybe a little bit of bourbon too. You know, it's
well, we're going to set you up. We're going to set you up. Yes, we will set you up with some good bourbon.
and ribs, I hope.
Yeah. Hey, ribs. We'll find you.
I mean,
because
I think the barbecue out there is kind of legendary, right?
Well,
more in Kentucky.
Yes, mm-hmm. Mr. Dark is down there. He lives close to Nashville, and down there, Memphis barbecue?
Yeah,
they got really good barbecue.
Well, that's some intense stuff. That's for sure. That's for true.
Mhm.
Mm-hmm.
So the dark one might snag you a bottle of sauce.
Can't go wrong there. I thought that's what we were talking about with the bourbon too. I mean, sauce comes in all kinds of flavors, I guess.
That's true. All kinds of forms.
I have some clear rub sauce that use to rub on your gums and stuff.
Exactly.
That's a solid rub. It's a clear liquid rub that you put on your gums and stuff, and
makes everything taste better.
Stuff, to make words come out easier and stuff. So
loosen you up a little bit. Yeah.
They say in wine there is truth, right? They say in vino veritas, right? In wine there is truth. Well, in bourbon there's just a whole lot of conversations. My understanding.
That's true.
Mr. Zimmer
would vouch for that one.
And in clear rub, there's a lot of slurring going on.
A lot of slurring, yeah.
It's got a bit of a kick.
Particularly if it rubs you the right way, I think.
That's it.
But I do have a technical question for you that I'm hoping that
absolutely.
You can answer for me. But when you're doing games and everything, what is the difficulty of going from 1D to 2D to 3D?
The biggest difficulty is where are you going to get the next D? Sorry, I couldn't resist that one.
Little therapy humor there.
One-dimensional games are pretty unidimensional, right? There isn't much to them. But in the 2D space, you pretty much are limited in your perspectives, right? You're pretty much going to look top down on something, and you're playing on a map. And that's basically any game you want to look at in 2D. When you go to 3D, what's really the tough thing about that transition is that, whenever we go to a new medium, the first thing people do is they copy everything from the old medium, right? People always do what worked in the last thing as the first thing in the next thing, because they don't really know what to do with the next thing yet because it's new. So as we started to get into 3D, 3D is something that sounds like, hey, games are just catching up to me. I live in a 3D world. I know what 3D is. I'm immersed in 3D all day, so I don't think there's going to be any problem with it. Well, okay. But the truth is we're not always playing games all the time. We're certainly not playing video games all the time in our 3D world. And all our gaming concepts basically were 2D originally. So when you go to 3D, there's all the technical challenges of trying to deliver that much extra processing, because there's a lot of extra processing involved in trying to really deliver a 3D world. But beyond that, it's the design. It's the accommodating the user's experience, right? Because the 3D experience is a very different way of engaging a game. Because if you do something 2D in a 3D world, it used to be all you need, and now it seems out of place and flat. No pun intended. But play experience is different, because when you have that third dimension, the possibilities for how you can engage the game and what point of view you're going to take, those things can now start shifting. They can even become part of the game play. So now it's not just how you, it's not just what you're doing in the game. It's how you're viewing the game that changes the experience of the game. And now you can make the point of view in the game part of the gameplay and actually an aspect, whereas in 2D you don't have that choice. So what it does is it creates the responsibility of having to deal with a tremendous amount more capability all of a sudden, and understanding what that is and how do you use it and how do you manipulate it in ways that enhance the user experience as opposed to just confuse them or become overwhelming and not in a fun way. So does that answer your question at all?
Yeah. I was figuring that other people out there would, you know, like to hear some technical as well as all the fun stuff. You know, because we have listeners that are in all aspects of this. You know, people like me that, you know, don't really play video games. I'm sorry, Holly. You know, I don't.
I know.
If you have listeners, period, you're way ahead of me.
Sir?
I said, if you have listeners at all, you're way ahead of me with the whole game. So it's all good.
But we have, you know, we have people like Holly's son that, you know, plays it almost professionally, or does play it professionally.
Oh yeah, people want to know the details and the ins and outs of games.
So.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to talk technically about games, things like that here and there at various levels. That's the thing. I like to try and talk about the technology at a level that anybody can understand it, but still has insight for people who really are aware of it. Hopefully. I mean, that'll always be the dream.
It's like there's a game that was invented back when everything was 1D. And it was an arcade game about a knight. It was about a knight and everything in a castle and going through the castle and everything and lava and, you know, the floor turning into lava and everything like that. And it was a major 2D step up.
Yes, I remember that game.
And I don't remember what
Dragon's Lair.
Are you talking about Dragon's Lair?
Oh, Dragon's Lair.
Dragon's Lair. Yes.
Or Dragon's Lair.
That was a big deal.
It did amaze me at the time. You know, of course, what they've got out today, you know, Dragon's Lair is not as big a deal, but it was a big deal at that time.
Oh, it was a big deal.
Definitely.
Had never seen anything like it before.
Right. Well, you know what the big deal with that game was? Because that was a pseudo video game, okay? And what I mean by that is that that game had a laser disc in it. And what that game was about, you know, most video games are about you get a controller and there's some object you control in the game and you run them around the screen, you do what you need to do, and you're in control of the action. With Dragon's Lair, what it was, because this was before they had really super graphics, and this game had actual, like, little movie things. You're watching stuff in super high quality. No video game had graphics like that. That's what made it so amazing, right? But the thing is that it wasn't computer graphics. This was just an animation that was played from a laser disc, and what the video game part of it was, every once in a while, they would stop the action, and you need to move the joystick, you know, one of four ways. And if you make the right choice, you keep going through the game. And if you don't, they play a disc. And when every time you move the joystick, it tells the computer to switch to another video set, another video stream.
Wow.
And as long as you pick one that doesn't have a dead end at the end of it, you're fine. Otherwise, it plays one that has a dead end, and then they end the game. But it was not technically a video game. Technically, what it was a laser disc viewer that you could occasionally hit a button and switch tracks. That's basically what that game was at the time. And most people bought it as a video game, and they thought, wow, look at what happened with the graphics. Why can't these other games have graphics like that? And it's because that wasn't really graphic. That was animation.
So it was a little different kind of technology.
That explains that. I never knew that part of it because it was one of those type things where the first time that I saw it in an arcade, I was just like, Now that is awesome.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah,
something
you've never seen before.
Yeah, because I remember when that came out, and it was such a big deal. Like,
absolutely.
As far as, everyone was talking about the graphics, this, that, it's,
what
et cetera.
Were
you I'm telling
everyone
how old I am.
Way beyond every other video game. So, but if you compare the graphics of that to, say, an animation or another movie at the time, you'd say, oh, yeah, I've seen graphics like that before. You just don't expect to see it in a video game, and it was really revolutionary for that. And really broke a lot of people's minds about what what a video game should be able to do. So it was kind of like they really pulled one over on a lot of the gaming public.
Wow. Tricky.
Uh-huh. I mean, because at that time, you didn't even have Duck Hunt.
Yes.
So we went from fun.
we went from
Pong and whatever else it was out there at that time to that, and I was just like, how the hell are they doing this? Because this is just a little box here.
And
sometimes
that was like
people
the era
put out
like
stuff.
Pac-Man and Q-Bert and all that kind of stuff.
Sometimes people put out stuff and you think, okay, I get it. I get where this came from. And sometimes you see stuff and it seems like the world just took a giant leap forward.
Mm-hmm.
And then
sometimes
you look at stuff and you don't realize that they were just kidding. it's not really what you think it is, right? It was a hocus pocus kind of thing.
And that's fine. I mean, because it was still a fun game to play.
Absolutely, and that's the point of a game, right? It should just be fun. It doesn't really matter how it's made. Unless you're like one of them geeks who really wants to know how it works, like me.
Nowadays, you've got all these games out there that do the same thing that one did, except it's all video. I mean, it's all game.
Right. It's all actual computer-generated graphics, absolutely.
Graphics.
In real time. I mean, real-time graphic generation.
Oh, it's crazy now. I know we 10 years ago, we're like, oh, they cannot get more clearer than this. There's no way. And now look at it. I mean, you have trouble even distinguishing, is that graphics or is that, like, real? It looks like it could be like a movie playing out.
And that's going to be a bigger and bigger problem as time goes on.
The
idea that when you can simulate stuff that well, that poses some interesting science fiction challenges that are becoming science fact.
when Beowulf came out as an animation, and you sit and you looked at it, and it was like, is that a real person or is that a animated person?
Right.
Yeah.
And eventually, they're going to not need real people in person. They'll need voice actors, but that'll be about it because they can animate everything.
Well, they're getting away with where they don't even have to have voice actors. If they have enough sound bite of a voice, they can imitate it.
It's true.
See, I argue that the quality of the pictures are going to become so crisp that eventually they're just going to have the actors come to your living room and act out the scene. And we'll have come full circle and go back to the old school theater where it's just people acting it out.
That's great. The traveling shows. Yeah. It's the troupe that comes to town. And that used to be how people got news in addition to entertainment, right?
I said all that with
storytelling.
That is all coming full circle.
It is.
That's right.
We do have a question from the chat room. From Clayton.
Please.
He said he's coded VNs. That's you should understand. I don't understand what he's talking about, but he said VNs. He said, why do you think visual novels never took off in the U.S.? He said, too much reading, too slow, or too action, too much action. Why do you think visual novels never took off?
Does he mean graphic novels, like comic book type stuff, only just real graphic novels, or does he mean visual novels like things that are movies?
He's saying something about what he put. Too crisp is back up into the uncanny valley. Film allows imagination. So I'm not sure what he's referring to.
Just the uncanny valley is an interesting thing. The uncanny valley, are you familiar with that?
No.
That's a phenomenon that's referred to. It's about the idea that when simulations are way off base, right? When you have a cartoon that's like really obviously a cartoon and it's ridiculous, it doesn't look anything like reality, that there's this thing where people accept it readily because we know it's not real, but we also know it's trying to represent something real, and we buy into the concept and we roll with it, right? And there's this thing that, so now things get more realistic and more realistic and more realistic until we get to this place where things are really close. It's pretty close. It's way closer than it used to be, but it's not exactly there.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between something that's really close and actually there is what they call the uncanny valley. And the reason they call it that is because people, if you make it too close without being dead on, people only see the difference. And they just go, oh, that's fake. That's bullshit. I don't buy into that. Whereas if it's totally fake, people get it. And we get where it's fake. You're not trying to make it real. But when you try to make it real and you're not quite there, you lose credibility in a way that something that's totally not real doesn't lose credibility. And so, and graphic novels, you know, can have that element to it. Is sometimes people can look at it and appreciate the story and go through it, and sometimes people just don't buy into it. And I don't think they are as accepted here as they are in a lot of other places. I think the person's comment is very accurate. Why they didn't catch on here? I mean, one thing could be expectation. One thing could be short attention spans. Because a graphic novel, you still have to take the time to read it. And most people would rather just watch something because, you know, Americans totally spoiled in terms of entertainment.
It's true.
Right? In that if you go around other countries, have you ever watched TV in other countries? I mean, really just looked at regular ongoing programming and stuff. It's like mostly until very recently, it just wasn't as clean, it wasn't as polished, it wasn't as well produced as stuff in America is. And we get this for free. You know, we get stuff, you know, slammed all over the place, super high quality, super expensive production. And in a lot of the world, that's not like that. And Americans are so used to having this super high quality production just basically handed to them that it's like sometimes it's hard for them to go shopping in other markets, you know, or whatever, because, you know, it feels like a step down, when I don't think it is. It's just a different form, right? And the thing is, in American media, it's so slick that it's baloney and people don't quite know it, right? Whereas, you know, if you watch some sitcoms in Latin America or some places like that, or some in Asian sitcoms, and you look at it, and even though you don't speak any of the language, you don't know what's going on, you can look at it, and it looks silly, right? There's a silly kind of quality to it. You know it's not real. You know it's just some goofy, over-dramatized thing. And that's kind of cool, right? That kind of positions it as actual entertainment. Whereas in America, this stuff is produced so slick and so cleanly that I think it's almost a problem that people actually believe it. And the idea that people, you know, do they know the difference between what's entertainment and what's actual? Increasingly, that's a question that I think researchers are looking at, and it's not clear what the answer is, which is kind of an interesting concept in and of itself.
Right. Especially with the advent of reality TV, quote unquote.
Exactly, I mean, the idea that we think of reality TV is having reality to it, which is also amazing.
Right.
I had a concept for a reality show. I actually pitched it to some people in Hollywood once. That was great.
Really?
You want to hear about this? This was great.
Yes, please.
This is this was my satire, right? This was like, I wasn't doing this seriously, but I wanted to pitch it to some Hollywood producers to see what they would do with it, because I got the chance to talk to some Hollywood producers. So I figured, what the hell? So I told them, I said, here's my concept. There's this show, and it's called Society's Child, right? That's the name of the show. And what this show is about is you have a couple that's getting divorced, and they're in a custody dispute. And so what it is this is a show that we're going to decide who gets the kids, you know, in this divorce.
Oh, my God.
And so, you know, and the show has three segments, right? First, you have this first segment where you have the couple, each of them explaining why they should get the kid, right? Then you have another segment where each of them is explaining why their partner should not get the kid. That's going to be a very juicy segment. And then in the third one, you either have like a therapist or a psychologist or something who's talking about what they know of the people so far, or you have the kid, you know, weigh in about where they would like to go. And then you have the studio audience or the call-in audience. You know, do it like you have a vote, like on American Idol or something, right?
Wow.
And the audience gets to choose who gets the kids. And there you go, and that's Society's Child. I think that would be a great reality show. And it's
actually,
like,
it would fit
to
say it would work. Actually, that would work. And you know
what?
Actually, it may be more fair than what a lot of people get in the judicial system, especially come from a rural town or whatever, and one side knows the judge or is related to the judge, or, you know, they don't get a fair trial. That at least would that would be a bias. You know, it'd be non-biased completely.
Yeah.
You know, but I pitched it to them as like a total joke, and they sat there for a while, and they're going like, well, you know, I wonder if what legal would say about it. I wonder, you know,
they
really started to kick it around, and I thought, wow, you know, sometimes life is just so absurd you can't even satirize it. And I think, you know, we're kind of living in those days, you know, which makes it interesting but scary at the same time.
Yeah, because I could see it working.
Absolutely.
You know, I think it's the same world. People would watch it. They would.
You could always change the name.
I think it'd be a very popular show.
You could always change the name of it from Society's Child to Solomon's Child.
Oh, that's good.
You know what?
That is good.
You'd have to be really careful. You'd have to be really careful when you cut to commercial, though.
Oh, wow. Boom, boom.
Exactly.
I've
been saving that one all week.
Oh, wow.
That is great.
I got a comment sent to me about visual novels. Not to segue the topic, I'm sorry. No, my nephew sent me a comment. He's listening and just sent me off out of the chat. He said, visual novels are a video game format popular in Japan. It's kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure book with prose descriptions and dialogue and multiple-choice decision trees, but augmented by images, music, and sometimes voice acting, which I think that sounds amazing. I would play the hell out of that.
So what they're talking about there is a different thing. What they're talking about is what I would call traditionally the interactive story, okay?
Yeah.
And that's a concept that is very tricky to do. It's been done a few times, and it's the idea is that you have a story that's evolving and going, and that the player essentially can redirect or redirect the story, and then see where it goes. And you can do it by having you pick some certain character actions or certain events that can happen or not happen at various times. Yeah. So, and what's interesting is that went to a concept that I actually proposed at the first brainstorm I was at Atari in 1981. I proposed this thing for the VCS. It was going to be a thing called the video vignette. Is what I called it, which was this idea of you get a bunch of characters and you give them each some properties, and then you just watch them play out a scene and see where it goes, which you could never really do on the 2600. That would be a ridiculous idea, but I thought it was a cool idea, but it was way too early for that. But now things like that are very doable. And that is good. And, you know, and so why doesn't that, why is that not catching on in the United States as much? I could tell you that. And that is because, you know, this, the interactive story, the idea of a combo movie video game has always been like this thing ever since movies and games started working together, you know, which is when I was doing this stuff for Spielberg in 81. That was like the beginning of movies and games really kind of trying to merge or trying to find the medium between them. And so here's, and people wanted, like, do you want a movie that you play or do you want a game that's like got a lot of story to it and is going on like that? And what they usually do, the way they've settled it is you have a game that you play and part of the rewards for the game are clips that are part of a larger story that it develops as you move your way through the game. But it's still basically playing a video game and then separately watching a movie in segments as it's going on, right? Because the interactive story, the actual, you know, the interactive movie, I don't think you can really do it. I don't think it makes sense, and here's why. Because video games... Well, an interactive movie, that's separate. But I mean, a video game movie combo doesn't work because video games are an interactive medium and movies are inherently a passive medium, right? Because with a, with a movie, the whole point of a movie is that I'm going to sit here and I'm going to give you my belief and attention. And the deal is you're going to take me somewhere interesting. But you're going to take me somewhere and I'm going to see where you take me. But I'm just going to watch. I'm the voyeur. Right? And in a video game, it's all about my action determines what happens. I'm driving this game and I'm trying to take it in a certain direction. When you do that with a movie, it's not always clear what you want or what the payoff is or what you get. When you're playing a game, when you achieve a certain skill level, you succeed, you know, you accomplish things, you win tasks, you beat challenges, and there's some inherent gratification in that. When you redirect a story, you don't know if you're going to a better story or a worse story or what's going on, right? All you know is you're making occasional random choices in an environment. And because when you try to mix an interactive thing with a passive thing, I think it just kind of breaks down. And that's why I think you see it as segmented now. But,
but
the interactive movie... I think that's what he means by the virtual novel is the interactive movie, essentially. And
there's actually a series. You were talking about the movie, Parson, Howard. There's a series that they did. They've only did like a couple little seasons here. It's called You Versus Wild. And you actually, you know what I'm talking about, Rebecca? You get like a segment and you go like on a. It is. It is him. And and you go, like, into the jungle, okay? And he'll say, okay, do you rappel down this cliff, you know, and risk blah, blah, blah? Or do you go, like, through this jungle portion and go around, you know? And you have to choose one. And
so
whatever
you
choose,
has a
result. You know what you're doing.
And then you go on.
At that point, all you're doing is playing Dragon's Lair. Right? It's exactly Dragon's Lair. You come to a place and you have a choice. You go this way or that way. And if you go that way, this happens. If you go this way, that happens. And then
that
you
happens.
See where you're at for your next decision point.
Right.
Exactly. That's exactly how
and
it works.
I was thinking about the movie Bandersnatch. It was on Netflix.
That's it, Bandersnatch.
And it was an offshoot of... Black Mirror. I couldn't think of it for a second.
Right.
But, I mean, not
exactly.
It was kind of like an extended episode, and it was like a choose-your-own-adventure thing, kind of.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean,
it, is.
It
and,
seems like there's
and then
an
you
existing...
want to go see all the pieces. You want to try and walk down all the different ways, and, you know, that's
to
great,
see the
result. Especially if you're OCD.
Yes. You want to go back because you want to see.
Yeah, you want to see what would have happened or what happened if I went that way.
Right.
But that's... You know, I don't know that that's the same. You see, watching a movie is a very different experience than that, right?
Oh, yeah, true.
So it's a different experience than
It's a different thing to do. It's a thing to do, and it can be a fun thing, but I don't think it's really the same as either a movie or a video game, but I don't think it's really quite a hybrid because your control is so limited, right? See, a real interactive movie, to me, what my idea of what would be a real interactive movie would be that you become a character in the film, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now
you
just start doing stuff. You do stuff and the film reacts to you. And that's what, like, you could be in a detective story and you just go and you talk to people and you shoot people or you do whatever you want to do in the thing and you maybe have a goal. You know, you're trying to figure out what the problem is and or what can solve the crime.
Does that segue into virtual reality then?
Well, that's what I was wondering. Yeah.
Could.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know enough about it.
Yeah.
But it's a massive amount of programming, right? I mean, it's to be able to make that kind of interactive environment and have it work, have it make sense, is an incredible amount of work, right? I mean, that's a huge task.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would be curious to know, like, what parts of the brain are active, like, when you're watching a movie versus playing a video game, and if... The, you know, like you said, putting the two elements together, is there, you know, just some kind of disconnect that it's not as pleasurable as doing fully one or fully the other.
Right. Whereas in the visual novel, like in Japan, there's so many different, it isn't just, if you go this way, this happens, if you go this way, this happens. You know, it's more, there's more to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now I really like the idea of doing brain scans and checking out people watching movies and playing games because I do think that's a really cool idea and you would probably see slightly different areas, you know, because there's a couple of things going on there with the brain anatomy, right? Because on the one level, when you're doing things, when you're doing an interactive activity, you are using more analytical centers and your motor centers are activated and you're thinking and doing things and you're planning and a lot of that's going on. When you're watching a movie, there's a part of you that is doing the analysis. You're trying to think about where it's going. There's also, there's a lot more interpretation. You're just looking at things and trying to just take them in and accept them and put them in various parts of your brain. But there's also the motor neurons. Right? The thing is, when you watch a movie, motor neurons give you the sense that you're actually doing the things that you're seeing. When you're in a video game, you're deciding what to do, and I'm not sure your motor neurons are quite as activated in a video game as they are in a movie, but your analytical centers are probably more active than they would be in a movie. But that's a really, that'd be some interesting research to do.
What about the difference between that and virtual reality then?
So virtual reality is great, but virtual reality has not quite reached the uncanny valley, right? So at this point, when you're in virtual reality, usually stuff is just grossly simulated, right?
Yeah.
So some things look pretty cool, right? But for the most part, the other people walking around and the things, the buildings that you're in and stuff, it's because it would be so expensive and it's almost impossible to deliver that high quality of graphic in real time, right? Because the one thing in virtual reality you need to have is you need to not have any lag. You want everything to work right now with everything that's going on. So you have to simplify it in order to be able to do that until we get more computing power. But to have characters that will respond to you interactively in a way that, A, they understand you, and, B, they make interesting choices in response to what you're doing, that could be a very interesting application of virtual reality, and I think would be extremely compelling. And the only problem is you probably have a lot of people in houses of ill repute almost the entire experience. Aside from
guaranteed,
but you know, it's interesting. But those kind of simulations are probably coming, and
without a doubt.
Now, that it would be an interactive movie. There's a case where you start off with a scenario and the movie responds to you and you just keep rolling through it. Like if you have a crime to solve, well, you could just keep working and working and working on it until you solve the crime. But the world can keep reacting to you. You know, people are getting away with it longer and they're doing better. Or maybe you have a time limit. Or maybe at some point that the people who you're trying to catch end up going after you. You know, and now that could put a time limit on the game, right? Then it's a kill or be killed kind of a thing.
You can
do some fun things with it. But you have to have AI that works. Or what you do is you create a shared virtual environment where people play. You know, like they have dinner murders, host a dinner murder? Party games? So imagine doing that in virtual reality where everybody is a character and they walk around and you see them and you can talk to them and chat with them, and but it's actually in a virtual environment. That could totally be
done. So is everyone else players? Like the other people are players too?
If all the world's a stage.
Ooh.
Right? Okay.
That would
so when's this
so
coming out?
Fun.
When are you going to get on this, Howard?
Yeah. I don't know why. Why am I such a screw-up? I'm never really doing the work I need to be doing. This is unbelievable. You're right. I'm wasting my life. But thank you for clarifying
really
that for me.
Awesome.
Have you done virtual reality yet, Howard?
I have participated in it for sure. Yeah, I have an Oculus, and I do go in there occasionally. It is cool. There is some cool stuff to do, but, you know, it's like you look at the various apps. Like there's a ping pong thing in there that's very cool, and there's also this world map. So I can go anywhere in the world and look around, but it's not fully interactive. Right. It's just basically, it's sort of like Google Maps. It's like a handy interface for Google Maps where I can say, I want to go here in the world. I want to stand here and look around. And I can stand there with the goggles and look around and see it. I went to go visit Mount Rushmore, which I've never been to. And I was able to walk around the park and finally get to a viewing platform. And for the first time, I got a good look at Mount Rushmore. And it felt like it felt very similar to being there, except I wasn't freezing my butt off. So that's nice. And that's in South Dakota. It's pretty cold there.
That's amazing. And then when you're done, you can just go get a soda out of the fridge, and you're done.
Exactly. And that's all it is. Or you could just get a pop, as they say in South Dakota, I guess.
Oh, wow. A pop.
A pop. Mm-hmm.
What was it? There was this one test that I saw that went through this. It went through this whole sieve of, you know, what do you call this? You know, is it a pop? Is it a soda? Is it this? Or are these roly-polies or sow bugs or things like that? And after you got through about five or six questions, it can tell you where you grew up. And it was remarkably accurate. That was a very interesting
app. Yeah, those are neat. To see what people call them, just cola.
When I lived in Tennessee, they were called Cokes.
Cokes, yeah.
That's true. Pop
like
is a little farther north. That's more like Minnesota, Wisconsin.
Yeah. Pop.
Yeah.
And they have brats, which are really just sausages.
Well, they're a different kind of sausage. Like you have sausages and then you have brats. And it's, I don't know. I grew up in Switzerland also, so.
That's cool.
Yeah.
My parents didn't have brats. My parents had brats.
Brats. Love it.
That's right. Now that's
love
Minnesota.
It.
Yes.
Yeah, in Indiana, Kentucky, they're brats. Yeah.
Brats. Yeah.
Well, in Minnesota, I think they're still brats if you're talking about the sausage. My parents just had brats, and we were in New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
Because we were all brats, I'll tell you.
Well, this is a segue.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, we've got about 6 minutes left here. So, Howard, tell everybody a little bit what you got coming up, what you're up to, and where people can find you to learn more about you, to buy your book, and all that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, anybody who's ever been involved in the creative process or with video games will probably really enjoy this book. And if you want to understand nerd culture better, this book can really help. As a therapist, I've actually had couples tell me that this book has helped their marriage, because when you have a nerd married to a non-nerd, which happens quite a bit, particularly out here, misunderstandings can happen that can be very stressful for your relationship. So this actually can help people understand their partner a little better. So the book is Once Upon a Atari, How I Made History by Killing an Industry. And it is definitely available on Amazon, and it's in an ebook and a paperback. Barnes & Noble, it's in all kinds of ebook sellers. And you can go to onceuponatari.com, and you can find me there, and you can find stuff about me and all things Once Upon Atari, because I have the book. I also have a DVD, the Once Upon Atari DVD, which is all the people who were making games at Atari in the early 80s telling about their experiences, and that's an interesting thing as well. All of that stuff, you can get autographed copies from my website at onceuponatari.com, or you can save money and just buy the book direct on Amazon or online at Amazon.com. Most people can find that one. Just go to Once Upon Atari or look for Howard Scott Warshaw. You can't miss me. Mm-hmm. And if you live in California and you're really having a rough time and you need some therapeutic help, come to hswarshaw.com and I can help you out as a therapist.
Can you do virtual?
I am totally virtual.
Can you do therapy Zoom meetings?
I'm not even sure I'm here right now. I do all my therapy work online right now, but I'll be back in the office probably in 2022.
What therapy, let everybody know what you specialize in.
Well, I am the Silicon Valley therapist. So my primary people who I deal with are high-tech leaders and the super intelligent and the people who are trying to love them. Those are my primary clients. I also deal a good deal with alternative sexuality clients, polyamory and kink and stuff like that.
Okay.
I do a lot of work with people who have trouble getting understood by other kinds of people. So I work with all kinds of people in all kinds of situations.
Fantastic.
That's fascinating.
It is an interesting practice, I've got to say.
Yes.
And
such a fast different, clientele. And then you've got, you got your video games, and then you've got this. But it did kind of segue. It really did segue.
Okay. I could write a segue, too.
When you make that new video game that we're talking about. When you make that new video game we're talking about, just call it Wars Revenge.
Oh, that's good.
There you go.
That's good.
Nice.
Because it can't be Yars Revenge. I thought maybe – I think Wars Revenge is pretty good. I do like it. Or I could also call it A Friend of Yars is a Friend of Mine, but I might get away with that. I don't know.
That's pretty good.
Oh, that's fantastic. That is fantastic. Well, it has been wonderful talking to you. If people can check you out, you will be a part of Imaginarium Virtual Convention.
Yay!
In July.
Virtual this year and in the flesh next year.
Yes. Yes. And I'm so excited about that. And people's going to love coming out and seeing you. And like I said, he'll be virtual this year. You can check in. We'll have some, workshops or something up our sleeves. Me and Howard will talk about it. Yeah. You can check him out and see how he's doing. And check out his book on Amazon.
Once Upon Atari. It's an amazing ride.
Check that out. I like it.
Well, cool. Thank you so much for coming back and sharing your vast wisdom. And
always a pleasure.
And we love having you on the show. With you're definitely going to have to be a regular. Come back and see us. But
as irregular as
so
I
much.
Am, I would love to be a regular on this show.
Yes. We could
take
talk.
Some more
we could go on and on talk about kinds of stuff.
We'll have to come back sometime and talk about therapy and psychology stuff. That's always fun, too.
Yes.
Oh, would be fun.
We'll do
yes.
that. Yeah, next time we'll do that. That'd be a neat show.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, save up those neuroses.
There you go. There you
well,
go.
We've got plenty. Between the, at least the co-host family, we've got a collection.
Yes,
excellent.
We'll have plenty to fill the time.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. I really do enjoy talking with y'all.
Thank you,
Well, thank you, Howard, and we'll be talking to you soon. And, yeah, come back anytime, man. We loved having
Excellent.
You on.
Will do.
Thank you so much.
Well,
you have a
great
good
to
evening.
Be here. Thank you. And you.
All right.
Take care.
Well, we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Now,
Bye-bye.
Tune in next week, guys, for another great show, New Star Chamber, on Wednesday at 9 p.m. And I will hand it over to our lovely Rebecca and Mr. Dark to have them sign off. I will catch you next week. Here you go, Rebecca.
Well, this has been an absolute blast. I can't wait to get to know more of Mr. Howard's work. You can check out everything about me on rgwesterman.com, Facebook, on Twitter, on Amazon, and I will see you guys next time.
And this is Daniel Dark.
As always, we promise you some of the best talents in the creative world. Tonight we brought you one of the greats. Hopefully you learned a few things from him that you can take on and be the best creative that you can be. Until we talk again next week, be creative.